Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste. This food is then provided to families and children in need. Being a kid should be about using your imagination, learning, and having fun. These children shouldn't have to miss out on simply being a kid because they're hungry. To find out how you can help end childhood hunger in your community, visit feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
This is Steve Earle, and you're listening to KPFT Houston Pacifica Radio for Peace.
It is 6 o'clock, Wednesday, time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling, and you're going to find it only here on Houston's community station, listener-sponsored KPFT. I am Hank Rubicek, producer of this award-winning show, and every week we place the spotlight on ordinary people with extraordinary stories to tell. You know, Kristallnacht, or the Night of Broken Glass, was a pogrom against Jews carried out on November 9th and 10th, 1938. It was the start of the Holocaust, ultimately murdering 6 million Jews and another 5.5 innocent souls deemed enemies as Nazi Germany. Exact numbers are hard to come by, but according to the Holocaust Survivors' Rights Authority, there are somewhere between 250 and 350,000 Holocaust survivors remaining, most of them living in Israel. Approximately 1,400 leave us every day. Their numbers dwindle, but their collective voices paint the landscape of Nazi concentration camps and the atrocities they endured, and display a common face, a poignant image of emotional resilience none of us can fathom. The second generation, children and grandchildren of Holocaust survivors, are charged with the responsibility of keeping these voices not only alive, but heard, loudly and clearly. Because while apathy and hate are dangerous, they become more threatening when we fail to grasp their powerful narratives. I'm a second generation. I was raised in Cleveland Heights, Ohio. Yeah, home of the football Kelsey brothers, for those of you who keep track. My grandparents were from Kovno, Lithuania. Actually, in a little village, a shtetl, if you will, called Slobodka. I'm not making that up. And you think Anatevka in Fiddler on the Roof was a strange name? When my son asks me about our ancestors and where they lived, I just tell him to watch Fiddler on the Roof. My grandmother and mother were in Stutthof concentration camp, and my grandfather in Dachau. I never met two-thirds of my family. My mother is alive, semi-well, in South Florida. She's 92, pretty young by South Florida standards. My stories consist of snapshots of their lives in the camps, reflections of liberation, times when instinct kept them alive, but mostly, they're stories about moments, specks in time that taught me more than I ever dreamed possible. Many of my second-gen peers say that their survivor family members never spoke much about the Holocaust. They kept it to themselves, leaving their children in the dark. Well, that was somewhat the case with my grandfather and my mother, but my grandmother, Grammy was not shy. But before I move into a few stories, let me tell you what first inspired me to tell them. And I promise it's not going to be what you expect. I first told stories about being raised by survivors when my roommate in graduate school was eating schmaltz. Now, most of you don't know what that is, so let me tell you. Schmaltz is chicken fat. You heard that right. Before you get all grossed out, Bobby Flay uses it in cooking because he has taste. Okay. But schmaltz is chicken fat. You know, it's that yellow stuff that comes off of the chicken. It comes into a soup. It's how you make chicken soup. You kind of pour it into a jar. It solidifies into this yellow stuff. Sounds pretty bad, right? Well, in graduate school, our mothers and grandparents would send us care packages. So one day, my three roommates and I opened up my care package, and we saw this jar. And one of my roommates asked, "What the hell is this?" I told him it's schmaltz. He said, "What is that?" I explained to him what I just explained to you, this chicken fat solidified in this jar. The first thing he said was, "How poor are you people? How can you possibly eat this and be alive after the age of 5? I told him, "Listen, just don't knock it till you try it, all right?" In the meantime, he couldn't even take the looks of it. None of them could. So he shoved it in the back of the freezer, not to realize that was actually the place to put it. Well, during that day, how should I put this? He ingested a few things that altered his mind. He was stoned, okay? And at night, not night, but 3 a.m, I came down for a glass of water. And I see my friend, John, sitting at the table in the kitchen with a knife and a loaf of Wonder Bread, unfortunately, but I still love him. And he's spreading glops of this schmaltz on bread. And I came in a glass of water. And he looked at me. He said, "This is the greatest blank I've ever eaten in my life. Tell me more about it." I told him a little bit more about it, but when he sobered up a little bit, he asked, "Tell me about your life, because any family that eats this has got to be interesting." Well, for the next 4.5 hours, I told him stories about being raised in a home of Holocaust survivors. So the show that I do when I talk about being raised in this house is Schmaltz on Rye, but more about that later. When I tell you these stories, it's a little interesting because, you know, before I talk about how all of this really took place, I've got to tell you that there are a few morsels from that morning that I'm going to offer, but I'm going to also throw in a few side dishes as well. My grandmother was a natural storyteller. I mean, she was the consummate storyteller. Everything that she ever told was in story form, and I mean everything. If I asked her, "Grammy, what's for dinner?" she'd sit me down and for the next 20 minutes talk to me about the little boy at the carnival. I look at her thinking, "Oh my God, do I have to sit here for 20 minutes and listen to this nonsense?" My eyes would roll, but she'd keep telling me the story. At the end of the story, I realized that it was all about never asking her what's for dinner again. Now, if she didn't have a story for something, she usually offered some kind of a perplexing response that made me think. It was a little sarcastic, a little witty, but I had to figure it out. So, for example, in high school, when I would ask her, "Grammy, do you like my girlfriend?" she would never say yes or no. What she'd say is, "Well, I was at the post office last week, and I didn't see her picture up on the wall." Totally puzzled, I asked her again, "But Grammy, do you like my girlfriend?" "Well, she had dinner over here the other night, and I could see that she could use a knife and fork. But Grammy, do you like her? I'm sure she didn't kill anybody." Well, that was her way of saying, "She's nothing special." Okay? She also had the uncanny ability to construct these impromptu apocryphal stories. You know, the kind that punctuates the character of the person in the story. Sort of like George Washington. In case you didn't know, George Washington did not chop down a cherry tree. But if he had, he would have walked over to his father and said, "Pa, I cannot tell a lie. I chopped down this cherry tree with my little hatchet." So it's not a story about chopping down a tree. Really, it isn't. It's about the character of George Washington. Well, she did the same thing, but she didn't realize it. For example, I remember telling her about a friend who was engaged 4 times to different women, and now he's engaged to the 5th. She began, "Well, there was a young man who had 2 shirts and couldn't decide which to wear to school, so he missed school. When he did go to school, He never had an answer to the question, what's your favorite subject? He had a lot of favorite subjects, but he couldn't just pick one. When he went to the candy store, he couldn't decide on the candy he wanted, so he went candyless. His mother often had smorgasbords at home, but he couldn't decide what to eat, so he went hungry. When I asked my grandmother, so what is the point? She said, don't go out and buy a suit yet. If I had a fight with my mother, which, you know, I did. I mean, who didn't, right? And I yell things like, you don't love me. You just don't love me. My grandmother obviously is living in the same house. She hears everything that's going on. So she sat down and taught me all about a mother's love. Another apocryphal story. She said, there was a young man whose fiance instructed him to kill his mother. I said, oh my God, this is getting gruesome. She said, well, he said to her, I'm not going to kill my mother. I love my mother. I love you, but I'm not going to kill my mother. That's a ridiculous thing to ask. She says, well, if you love me, you're going to have to do it. Well, you know, he just reluctantly succumbed and he said, okay, I'll kill my mother. So one day his mother is cooking in the kitchen and he goes in and he gets a butcher knife, walks over, stabs her, leaves her for dead, thinking she's dead. He runs out the kitchen, panics, trips over pots and pans, and in her near death, his mother raises her head and says, did you hurt yourself? That was her way of explaining a mother's unconditional love. Even if she's near death, she's going to love you. Even if you are the killer. You get the idea, right? She also had some great sayings. If you say, he always needs money, she would reply, well, a sack in a hole can never be filled. The statement, he has to be rich, would yield, did you count his money? If she saw you rush through some task or project, she would assert, you know, a good tailor should measure 10 times before cutting. Honest to God, she could just teach every Harvard professor who taught job enrichment that statement, and they would know it all. God, she was smart. I measured a lot, too, you know, that tailor thing, because she told me that I should never wait until tomorrow to do what I can do today. Now, I find that one mildly perplexing because that would make every day today, right? Not too long ago, a few years ago, I was telling my mother that my obsessive-compulsive disorder was learned from my family. And she looked at me and said, why would you possibly say that you would learn it from your family? Well, here's what I told her, and this is the short course, all right? My grandmother used to cook in the basement because she didn't want to get the kitchen messy. We had a rug under the dining room table. It had fringes. Every day, she would take a rake and rake the fringes so they would be even. If you had dinner over our home, well, you'd have a great meal, but you better eat fast because she's going to grab the dishes before you're done. She had to puff up those pillows perfectly on the sofa before she went to bed. My grandfather worked at a paint warehouse. He woke up at 5:30 every morning. He came home at 3 in the afternoon. I worked with him for several summers. He took paint and put them on pallets into trucks. That's what he did till he was 74 years old. And he was exhausted, as you might imagine. So after Walter Cronkite, man, he just fell asleep. He was on that one chair in that the dining room and corner dining room, and he fell asleep. But at 7:45 every night, not 7:46, but 7:45 p.m., my grandmother woke him up so he could walk slowly, almost sleepwalking, into the kitchen and have tea. In a glass. Oh, they had cups, but they used glasses. Somehow, tea, hot tea, tasted better in a glass. You couldn't hold it. And it was usually those Flintstone jelly glasses, you know what I mean? Piece of hard sugar. They had tea every night. And then he went to bed, filled with more caffeine. But every night. If you walked into our house, you had to take your shoes off before entering the house. The door is always open, too, so you could sneak in really easily, right? A little story here. Usually when my grandmother had her brothers or sisters come over, she had a family of 13. Many of them died. She had 9 when she came to this country, all living within a mile radius of each other. They just walk into the house. They knocked on the door sometimes, but usually not. They just walked into the house. It was open. So I'd be coming downstairs from my room or coming out of the kitchen, and I'd see my Aunt Ruthie sitting there in a chair as if she belonged there, or my Uncle Sam or Aunt Benny or Uncle Benny or my cousin Warren. They were just sitting there in the living room. They walked in, took their shoes off. You can't hear them because obviously their shoes are off and they're sneaking in, and they're just sitting there in the living room, waiting for somebody to say hello. The strangest thing. But for us, it was normal. Very normal. Happened almost every day. And I lived in that kind of an environment. And as strange as it sounded, I loved every bit of it. So, did I learn to be a little OCD? Well, let's just say that I'd like to be buried in the Container Store. The last Thursday of the month at our house was family night. It was called family night because, well, family came over to play cards, eat, smoke, have fun. All right. So this happened the fourth Tuesday of every month. My grandmother was riddled with arthritis, so she couldn't go anyplace. So everybody came to our house, had a large dining room. It started around 7 at night after dinner. And I'd be upstairs in my room. And this is what I would hear. Things like, Benny, put a penny in the pot. Sam, you owe me a nickel. Shut up. Be quiet. They would yell at each other, scream at each other. They'd laugh. They'd sing. You'd hear a few pennies and nickels going into an ashtray. You'd smell smoke. They'd be making coffee, drinking tea, eating food all night, all morning. Food would manifest itself from the basement. New baked stuff that I never saw before that my grandmother prepared for the evening. They were all yelling at each other, lovingly. I couldn't sleep. I just wanted to hear what they had to say. And then at 6 a.m., they all went to work. They went to work at 6 a.m. after family night. You know, visiting my grandmother, and so many people did, was so much fun because she could really entertain anyone for the whole day. I mean anyone. She'd bring out photographs. She'd tell stories. She'd engage in beautiful conversation. She was always able to give signs that she listened, nodded her head. Mm-hmm, uh-huh. She would always do what was right to give you the impression, and the right impression, that she paid attention to you at every turn. People loved talking to her. She could also make you contemplate by just uttering a few words with the right cadence. For example, there was this minister friend that she had who was over the house one day, and they were talking in the kitchen, and I came into the kitchen to get something. I forget what it was, but this minister was talking to my grandmother. Razel was her name. He called her Rose. In English, it was Rose, and he was talking about Christianity, and he was talking about Jesus and talking about so many things. And then he asked her, well, Rose, what do you think about Jesus? What do you think about all of this? And my grandmother looked at her and said, he was a wonderful boy, but God? That's what she said. That's what she did, and all he did was laugh. All you could do was laugh and love her because she made so much sense. Learning respect was a big part of my life growing up. I always like to tell the story about Maury Maltzmacher down the street. When I was 14 years old, between 14 and 16 years old, every Friday, and I mean every Friday at 4 p.m., it was my job to walk down the street to Drexler's drugstore. Now, Drexler's drugstore carried what was called the Jewish Forward, Jewish newspaper, was published in New York. It was distributed all over the country, and it came to the drugstore at about 3:45. So once they unpacked it, I had to get it at 4 o'clock because they went fast, and I had to get it from my grandfather. So on the way down to Drexler's drugstore, I had to pass by a little store called Maury's Shoe Store, Maury Maltzmacher. Now, Mr. Maltzmacher was also a Holocaust survivor. I knew him well. My grandparents knew him well. His daughter, Sylvia, went to school with me. Now, I don't know why I never learned my lesson. I eventually did, but I swear for several months I didn't learn my lesson. I'd walk by Mr. Maltzmacher's store, and I'd wave, right? What's wrong with that? I'd wave, and then I'd keep walking. And then he would come out of the store, and he'd say, "You call that hello?" Said, "Mr. Maltzmacher," I waved, I said hello. He said, "That's not a hello. You call that a hello?" I said, all right, I got the idea. So I walked into the store. We talked a little bit. Asked me about my grandmother. I told him. Asked me about my grandfather. We talked about a few things. He asked me if I saw Sylvia, you know, his daughter. And I say, "Yeah, I see Sylvia every day in class. She's doing just fine." And then I would say to her to drum up, I would say to him to drum up conversation, "You know, I guess I need new shoes in the near future." Now, he sold shoes, remember? He was also a cobbler. But he said, "Why do you need new shoes? I fixed those last year. They look fine." This is a man who sold shoes. After our conversation, I'd continue walking down the street. I got the newspaper. But here's the thing. I couldn't dare walk back on the other side of the street, because he'd think I would be ignoring him. Couldn't do that. So I had to walk back on the same side of the street, and you bet I couldn't wave. When I walked back, I walked into the store, and this is not more than 5 minutes later, and I said, "Mr. Maltzmacher, it was nice seeing you. Have a great Sabbath. Have a great evening." And I waved. Doesn't sound like much, right? But I want all of us to kind of ask ourselves this question. How often is it that we take the time to spend the time with someone? I just learned to take time for others. Generosity of time and heart. It was so important in my life. I forgot that. So many of us do. I can't think of things a whole lot more important than that. Not at all. This is Hank Rubicek, and you're listening to So What's Your Story? And if you enjoy listening to us, and I hope you do, we're on every week, every Wednesday at 6 p.m. on KPFT Houston, 91.1 FM on the dial, and kpft.org, any place on the planet. Also 89.5 in Galveston and 89.7 in Huntsville. Want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. We have a storytelling swap the fourth Tuesday of every month. It's virtual, so anybody can join us. It's from 7 to 8:30 Central Time. The link is always the same, and it is on the Houston Storyteller site, which is houstonstorytellers.org. And please join us, 7 to 8:30, fourth Tuesday of the month. And also, if you wanted to crank up your storytelling skill, you might want to join the Tejas Storytelling Association at tejasstorytelling.org and the National Storytelling Network. And our Friends of the Moth is holding its Grand Slam competition, a cluster of past Moth champions, next week on December 6th at the Heights Theater and on 19th Street and in the Heights. Tickets are available, but not for long, because this is really a very, very popular activity. So find them at themothhouston.org. Basil, I wanted to take a break here for a moment. Thank you for coming in tonight, first of all.
Glad to always be here.
How was your Thanksgiving, my friend?
My Thanksgiving was very good. Got to meet some good family that came through from out of town, and then also got some good food. So,
When you say meet family, was that like for the first time?
For some of it was the first time.
No kidding. Who'd you meet for the first time?
I met a cousin from Chicago.
Yeah.
For the first time. So it was pretty nice to see.
Close cousin? Second, third?
I think it was like third. Honestly, my family, like, history is sort of very interwoven, so sometimes it's hard to know what the number is before the cousin, but yeah, I want to say it was like third cousin, I believe.
That's neat. That is so neat. Well, I'm glad you had a good one.
Yeah, how was yours?
It was nice. It was very nice. It was small but quiet. Small but quiet. Yeah, it was nice. It was
good. Very so, nice. So no out-of-travel family or out-of-town family coming through?
No, not this year. In the past, yes. This year, it was just my wife and me and her mother, who's 101 years old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, no kidding. I'd like to feel like that now. Yeah, she's in pretty great shape.
Well, that's pretty good.
Just remarkable. Give her a couple of martinis and she's good to go for the night.
Oh,
she's
wow.
Just remarkable. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was nice. It seems like a lot of people that make it to that age really do well.
It's the martinis. It's the martinis. I had a great grandfather, long as we're on the topic, Fischel Miller, my grandmother's father. He lived to be 103. He smoked 2 packs of cigarettes every day.
Oh, pack wow.
of Winston, cigarette hanging out of his mouth every day. Died at 103. Must have been the cigarettes, huh?
It probably yeah. is, yeah. They say don't drink those things, don't smoke those right. things, and it's like that's what makes them live so long.
Let me tell you something. If I live to be 103, I'm going to start smoking. That's all I can tell you right now.
Right? Yeah, I mean better yeah. late than never, I guess.
That's right. That's amazing. You know, my grandmother actually saved my mother's life twice. I mentioned to you that my mother and my grandfather were in Stutthof concentration camp. It was in eastern Poland. It was actually very close to the Poland-German border. And when they checked into Stutthof concentration camp, my grandmother was very intuitive, very instinctive. She heard things all over the place. And so many survivors were. She wasn't the only one. And she heard the number 14. Now, she didn't know what that meant. Honestly, she didn't know what it meant. But she kept hearing people say the number 14. She heard the Gestapo yell the number 14. And my mother was 13. So just instinctively, when my mother was checking in to Stutthof, as she was about to tell the Gestapo her age, which was 13, my grandmother pinched her real hard. And my grandma and my mother yells, "Ouch!" And then my grandmother answers for her to the Gestapo, "Oh, she stepped on a stone. That's why she screamed. She's 14 years old." As it turns out, if you're under the age of 14, you're separated from your mothers, and you are immediately killed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's horrible.
It is horrible. And how she knew that, how she felt that, you know, instinct works like this subjective computer, this non-rational knowing. I don't know. But it was just remarkable. It really was remarkable. Also, she was in the Stutthof death march. Several concentration camps and death camps had this death march. The Allies were coming over the Eastern Front, and the Russians, of course, were coming over the Eastern Front, and they liberated my mother and my grandmother at Stutthof, but they were in a death march. The Nazis wanted to get rid of as much evidence as possible, and of course, that meant people. And as they were walking, again, my grandmother, being as instinctive as she was, knew that this was something wrong. There was something wrong going on. They were about to be liberated, but they were being shuffled into the wilderness. There was something wrong. About 20 yards from where they were walking in one particular location was a small shack, small barn, a small shack, very small shack, about 20 yards away. And my grandmother tells the story that there weren't any guards in that vicinity. So she grabbed my mother, who was terrified, so she grabbed her by the hair, dragged her, with two friends who were standing, walking behind them, and they ran into that little shack. My grandmother said that as soon as they shut the door to this little shack, they heard machine guns spraying all over the place, killing hundreds of women who were in that line. All of them were slaughtered.
Oh, wow.
All of them. And then 10 minutes later, my grandmother knew Russian, and 10 minutes later, she heard Russian voices outside of this little shack. There were Russian soldiers there to liberate them. So they came out of the shack and said, "Here we are," and they were liberated. So again, that's how she saved my mother's life.
That's very good instincts, yeah.
Yeah, when I do tours at the Holocaust Museum, which I've been doing for 25 years, I tell that story to to a lot of kids who are on tours with me, and they're amazed by that. And I simply tell them, I'm glad you are, because if you weren't, I wouldn't be here to tell you. And it's amazing how our lives are so inextricably related to each other. It really is. It's just amazing. Well, after they were liberated from the concentration camps, my grandfather was liberated from Dachau. He was liberated by the Americans. The wonderful photograph where you see General Eisenhower and Patton and Montgomery. It's a famous photograph where they're at Dachau liberating it, right? And General Eisenhower has his arms crossed, looking at the dead people, thinking, how could this possibly happen? That's when he recruited all of these Western photographers to take pictures, because he knew that one day people would deny this happened. He knew that. He was a prognosticator. And he knew that people would deny it, and they weren't allowed to. So he took these photographs. In any event, this was the camp where my grandfather was, in Dachau.
Yeah.
And they were liberated. And, backing up a little bit, my family lived in Memel, Germany. And they moved there from Lithuania a few years before because they heard that Germany was safe. I mean, Germany was the height of intelligentsia, right? I mean, Germany had the smartest people in the world. They really did. This is the country that gave birth to Mozart, Bach, Beethoven. This is a country that didn't know from functional illiteracy. This is a country that had so many professors and engineers and doctors who were Jewish, and they were seen as such a tremendous threat. My grandmother used to tell me that if I was a professor in Germany, I'd be the first one killed because they were seen as such a threat. So in any event, they moved to Germany, and then afterwards, when they were liberated, my mother and my grandmother were sent to Lodz in Poland by freight train. And the interesting thing is, while they were on this freight train, they were gathering food so that they had something to trade for food on the way, because they needed clothing, so they would trade for clothing. They would trade the food. And on the way, my grandmother met a friend on the way to Lodz. And this friend said to her, "Oh, it's so great to see you. I'm so glad you're alive. Have you seen your husband?" And my grandmother, of course, said, "No, I haven't found my husband yet. I don't know where he is." And she said, "I lost my husband." And my grandmother was very, very saddened by this because they were friends. And she said, "But I want you to have this." And what was it? It was her husband's wedding ring, right? And my grandmother said, "Of course, I can't take your husband's wedding ring. I'm not going to take that. That's I would never take that." She said, "I want you to have that because you're a person who I believe has so much hope. You've always been that kind of a person. And I believe that if you hold on to this ring, this emblem of love, you're going to find your husband." Well, she did take the ring. And a day and a half later, she found my grandfather.
Oh, wow.
He had help from a Jewish-Russian soldier who helped him identify where they were in Lodz. But they found each other. But here's the story about the ring. I didn't even know the story about the ring until I married my wife in 2012. My mother produces this ring. I said, "What is that ring?" She says, "Well, this is your grandfather's ring." I said, "You didn't show it to me until this now? Until now? How come you didn't show it to me years ago when I was married years ago?" She said, "Well, I didn't like that woman. I like this one."
With her instincts, that's good taste.
It's just amazing. Here it is. Here it is right here. It's that ring. It's that gold ring. And it's amazing. I mean, even the same size as my grandfather's finger. But yeah, that's that ring story that I find just remarkable, In 1994, my mother was interviewed by one of Steven Spielberg's representatives for the Shoah documentary, the Shoah Project, that was underway. And, he had representatives who were interviewing survivors all over the country. My mother was living in Florida at that time, kind of part-time, but she was there. And she was being interviewed. And, my mother isn't a lot for words, and I didn't know if she would do really well, but I saw the interview on VHS a few weeks afterwards, and I was astonished. It was an interview of the most incredible caliber. I can't believe she said what she said. I heard stories I never heard before. While this woman was interviewing my mother was pointing to a small dried flour in a small frame. Dried flour that obviously has been around for years in a small frame. And she tells the story that this flour was a flour that my grandfather gave to my grandmother the day before they were deported. My grandfather gave it to her and said, "Try to keep this and know how much I love you." A small flower. Well, my grandmother found a way for 3 years in Stutthof to keep it not fresh, but kept it intact, this one flower. I don't know how she did it. And it was one of the few things she had when she came to this country. And she put it in a frame. And my mother told me that story. Well, she told the world that story. And I thought, I can't possibly imagine a more beautiful love story than this. I can't possibly imagine it. I mean, you can create one, but it didn't have the kind of naturalness, the kind of authenticity that my mother served it up with. It was just an incredible story. And I found it interesting, too, because, you know, my grandmother used to be able to go in the backyard and literally grab a dandelion, a weed, and she'd bring it into the house. She'd put it into a little glass of some sort, and she would somehow make it look like a most beautiful, glorious bouquet. It's what she did. She made a living. We made a living. They made a living. My grandmother made a living peddling aprons. And my grandfather, as I said, didn't sell paint, but he loaded paint onto a truck at a paint warehouse in Solon, Ohio, outside of Cleveland. You know, everybody talks about, a lot of people talk about, oh, I was poor, I was poor, I was poor. I got to tell you something, man. I really was poor. We really were poor. That's the truth. No hyperbole here. We were poor. But somehow, I didn't feel like I was lacking anything. I mean, nothing. I had the best friends. I had a bike. I played baseball. Somehow, I got gifts. I had birthday parties. I was never hungry. I didn't know what a restaurant was until I was 15. But nevertheless, I never went hungry. And I had a great life growing up. And it was embedded in all of this sadness and tragedy. But I didn't feel the sadness and tragedy growing up at all. But she made everything really beautiful. You know, my father, I hadn't talked about him, but my father wasn't a survivor. He was born in Cleveland. He left when I was 14 years old. He wasn't a bad man, but he was sick and he was weak. So I was really fortunate to have my grandparents, my grandfather in particular, who really filled in that father role so much. My grandfather was a man of very few words, but every word that he said meant something. My grandmother, as you could probably tell, was kind of talkative. She was kind of, you know, bubbly, but my grandfather, a man of very, very few words, but every word meant something, every word. And he never said a bad word about anybody, and I mean anybody. And this guy was in Dachau for 3.5 years. If anybody had a bad word to say, it would have been him, right? But he never said a bad word about anybody, nobody. And I think about that a lot, because growing up, he did things that didn't require any words. But yet he communicated so clearly. For example, I don't know if any of these listeners, boomers, if you're listening, you know who Leave It to Beaver is, right? Leave It to Beaver in Eastern time. It was on 4 o'clock every day. Okay. So I used to come home from school. I'd be laying on the floor watching Leave It to Beaver. All right? The Beav. And my grandfather would come home about that time, and every day, and I do mean every day, he'd buy me a pack of M&Ms because that was my favorite. He'd walk up to me while I'm laying on my back, and over my head, he'd shake the M&Ms just to let me know, just to let me know that he didn't forget me. And he never did. I remember I stole a cigarette from my mother one day. And it was really cold outside. It was a snowstorm. I figured, hey, this is a great time to kind of sneak one. Nobody's out. So I sneak a cigarette. I'm walking down the street. And who's walking toward me on the same side? My grandfather. And I'm caught, right? I'm smoking a cigarette. I'm about 13 years old. And all he does is look at me and, you know, shakes his finger, right? You know what I mean? Like, shakes that finger. Naughty, naughty, naughty. He never ratted on me. He never did. The best memory I have of my grandfather is a story I tell frequently. It's when started when I was 5 years old. When I was 5 years old, my grandfather started to tell me a story about a watch that he had when he was in concentration camp. Now, keep in mind, I'm 5 years old, all right? So he tells me a story that he has this gold watch that he kept in his sock while he was in Dachau concentration camp. Now, keep in mind, I don't really know what Dachau concentration camp is. I certainly don't know what a gold watch is, but I listen to him, and I love him. And that's why I listen to him. So the story is, he has this watch that he kept in his sock. He was a young man. He was a laborer, so he was able to keep his clothing. He kept it in his sock so the Nazis wouldn't find it and take it away. He kept it in his sock, and it was also a symbol of hope that one day he would run across my mother and my grandmother again. Now, he told me this story every year for 21 years. How do I know it was 21? Because a few days after my 26th birthday, when he told me this story, he was diagnosed with leukemia. We didn't think that much of it because we knew that many elderly people survived leukemia, but for him it wasn't the case. I was there when my grandfather died. I saw his soul leave his body. I was there. I was watching him. I saw him, and he was turning white and then sort of bluish. And I knew what just happened. I walked up to him, and I put my hand over his face, over his mouth, to feel if there was any life. I didn't feel anything. And then to my left, I saw some steam, not unlike the steam that you would see coming out of a tea kettle, but it was just a little dose of steam, just for a quick second, just a flicker. And I knew that that flicker was his soul. A few days later at his funeral, a very good friend of the family came up to me with a small box, cotton laced. And in that box was that gold watch. And under the watch, there was a little note that read, "I love you," which, again, was very typical for him, because he was a man of very, very, very few words. Very few words. You know, my grandfather had this 55 Ford Fairlane. God, it was kept immaculate. My God, it was like a flawless car. And sometimes I look in that car. I remember looking into that car. And I remember at this storytelling festival a few months ago, there was a wonderful, wonderful storyteller whose name is Bernadette Nason. She's been on this show several times. Brilliant woman. And I was in a workshop, actually, on how to write a memoir. One of the exercises in this memoir writing workshop was to think of a car growing up, look in the car, what do you see, and create a story from what you see. Now, what I did is, and I never thought about this before, but I thought about that 55 Fairlane. I looked inside the the driver's side, and I saw my grandfather's seat in front of me. I remember I saw that green seat because he was short. It was a way of seeing over the windshield. And then I remember walking over to the other side, the passenger side, and I remember looking in, and I remember seeing cracker crumbs. My grandmother, whenever she got in that car, would put crackers in her purse because she was terrified of starving. She'd even, you know, we'd go down the street a mile to my Aunt Ruthie, and she'd want to make sure she had crackers in her purse because she didn't want to starve. And that's what you saw on that side, in that car, in that driveway, during my life. Yeah, that really came to my mind. My grandfather, he was very encouraging to me in my life. He was, my grandmother was encouraging, everybody was encouraging, but my grandfather in particular was kind of encouraging. I was a stutterer when I was in junior high, right, middle school for some of you, but junior high and through 10th grade. I mean, I didn't raise my hand and say a whole lot in class because by the time I got the words out, it would be time for summer break, okay? And if not that, my friends would laugh at me. And it was no big deal. It was more of a self-concept issue. But, you know, long story short, the way I worked it is that I learned the International Phonetic Alphabet. I learned about pa and ba because when I started, I used to say pa 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 pa. You couldn't tell if it was a P or a B. So I used to look in a mirror and I used to work my lips, you know, pa 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 ba 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 pa 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 ba ba ba. And my grandfather watched me do this and he was so encouraging. He said, good for you, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. When I was in college, when I got to college, you know, I had overcome my speech problem, and there was a job, an internship, but it was a paid internship at WOSU. I did my undergraduate at Ohio State at the radio station, right? Radio station. It was a job for a DJ. It was a, you know, hard rock radio show, midnight to six, twice a week. All right. So you had a audition for this. Now here's the thing. Keep this in mind. In order for me to overcome that speech problem, I had to work in front of a mirror, right? I had to work in front of a mirror. Now, I was so afraid that if I were going to be given tongue twisters in this audition, and I was afraid that if I didn't have a mirror to look into in order to articulate clearly, that I wouldn't be able to do it. Follow? All right. So I take this little mirror, a little makeup mirror, with me to this audition. And everybody smoked in those days too, right? So I had this little beanbag ashtray. So I'm walking into the radio station with a little beanbag ashtray and in this little mirror. And the professor who was doing the auditions, you know, he's smoking himself and he looks at me. And he introduces himself, and I say to him, look, I know this is going to be really, really strange, but I need to look into a mirror when I'm given audition pieces because I learned how to speak clearly by watching my lips work. And he looked at me, and he said, hey, hell, it's radio. No one's going to be seeing you. Go for it. Okay. So I had this mirror set up in front of me, right? I got the mirror set up in front of me, and I have the little beanbag ashtray there, and I am going through these tongue twisters. And, you know, I had troubles with B and B's and P's, and by golly, I knew what would happen, and I got it. I got the first tongue twister was, Big Bad Bill would buy a Bull Bob a beer. So I looked in the mirror. Big Bad Bill bought Bull Bob a beer. Big Bad Bill bought Bull Bob a beer. Big Bad Bill bought Bull Baba Bear and did all the right stuff and went on and on and on, you know, and did all of these tongue twisters, and I did it. And, you know, the guy turned to me and he said, "You are really good. I got to say, this is a little astonishing. I don't think I've had anybody walk in here with a beanbag ashtray and a mirror, but, man, you did a great job. You are hired." I was thrilled as could be, right? And in many ways, it was my grandfather who really kind of encouraged me. He didn't laugh at me, right? My grandfather did not laugh at me when he saw me do these ridiculous things in front of the mirror. So I remember my friends years later, when I would tell them that story, they would say, "So it was really your grandfather that helped you get this job. I mean, that's how you did it." And I said, "Nah, I just did it with smoke and mirrors."
That's a funny punchline.
You like that one?
That's
right?
A good one.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
What do you think of that story? You were kind of looking amazed, right?
No,
yeah, that was a true story. Yeah,
it's a good one. I really just like how it builds up to the punchline.
Did it build up to a punchline?
Yeah,
you know, yeah. I wish it was a joke. It wasn't a joke, but I mean, yeah, it sounds like one. You know, life is much stranger than fiction, isn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, it was. But he was just so, I don't know, he was just so encouraging. They all were, you know. I have so many stories, really, to tell about my grandmother and my grandfather and my mother, and sadder stories about my dad, you know, who left early. And I don't tell a whole lot of stories about him because it's very hard. It's painful sometimes. But, you know, it's one of the reasons why my favorite play is I Never Sang for My Father by Robert Anderson. It's a story about Robert Anderson is a playwright who writes about the fact that his father was difficult to get along with. He didn't give him a whole lot of support. And when his father asks him, "How come you never sang for me?" he said, "I didn't want to sing for you because you weren't encouraging." Well, that wasn't exactly what was happening in my life, but it was hard. It was just hard. I never sang for my father. Let's just say that. I don't think he ever really wanted me to.
Is it okay if I tell a story about my father?
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. Have you got a couple of minutes? Is it a couple of minutes long? What do you got?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could try to expand it to be a couple minutes.
Yeah, but, or make it 1 minute. No, I just, no, absolutely, go for it.
Yeah, just because speaking of fathers, my dad hasn't been in the picture for a while, not because of like any huge circumstance, but just because my mom and I moved away from him and sort of have been separated in that sense. But there are a few things that I remember, and I was very young when we sort of separated in that sense. I was like 5, 7, somewhere around there, so not a lot of cognitive memory being with him. But I do have like small fond ones with him, and the one that I remember the most was we had this basement in New York, upstate, so very small town. Everybody has like a house, and we had a basement because we were living on top of a hill, so we were like able to have a basement in the area we're in. And they had built that house from scratch, so it's like everything sort of new. When I was maybe like 5 or so, like the house was 5 years old at the same time, so it's like very, very new. Still, stuff was still like being built in the basement, especially because the basement was mainly just concrete. Like all concrete. Like if I were to run around and like fall and trip, like I would go to the hospital. Luckily I didn't do that. But one thing that I've always noticed when I went in the basement was there was one light like as you go down the stairs, and then there was like another light as you go to the other side.
Yeah.
So in that area I was always very scared
yeah.
to like go down. And one time when I went down I saw a spider. In the corner there was like a spider web. It looked horrifying because of the lighting. And I was like, I'm scared. Right? So I told my dad about it like the next day. I was like, "Hey, Dad, I saw the spider. Like, I'm scared of the spider." And then he sort of looked like unfazed by it. He's like, "Why would you be scared of the spider?" And I was like, "Oh, because it looks scary. I don't know what it is. It's all creepy with the lights and all that." And he was like, "Well, there's nothing to really be afraid of because if anything, that makes sure that we don't have any flies in the house." So don't be afraid of the spider, because he's helping you more than you're helping it, really.
That's great.
I always remember, and I think from that point on, I haven't really been, other than like tarantulas.
Yeah, they're a little scary.
Yeah,
but that's a different caliber. Yeah.
But since then, I've not really had like a spider fear, because I was like, oh, they are helping me with the mosquitoes. Yeah. And anytime I'm around, there's not many mosquitoes outside. I'm like, thank you, spiders. Like, I have.
That's very cool.
Somebody to thank. So
that's so cool. It's amazing the things we remember, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah, I, you know, I didn't hear the voices of my grandparents growing up. Maybe I heard them, but very rarely. I sort of made up for it by now listening to my mother in real time. But now I listen to my grandparents' voices every day, especially my Grammys. I see her walking, baking, setting the table, laughing, crying and praying. She guides me. She is my compass. You know, I get this intriguing message every time I leave this station, KPFT, a place gracious enough to give me a platform for these stories and so many others over the years, including great ones that Basil just told us, things that are impromptu. But you see, when I leave this station, I pass Holocaust Museum Houston, located down the street, on the way home. I don't know what to make of it, but I think it means something. It's all about remembering voices and the power of story. Oh, and by some incredible miracle, if any of you come across a jar of schmaltz and find inspiration when spreading it on bread, make sure it's rye. Hudson is up next with Living Art, another KPFT exclusive. Make Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1, a part of every day. Be sure to join us every Wednesday at 6 p.m. for So What's Your Story? If you keep loving a great story, I'm going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank Rubicek, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that even if a story doesn't end happily, it doesn't mean you can't live happily ever after. Peace.
Matt Appel, your host for the Jam Band Hour on Friday nights at 6 p.m. on KPFT. Join me to get your weekend off to a great start as I play prime cuts of live classic and current rock from artists ranging from the Grateful Dead, Allman Brothers Band, and Blues Traveler to current and emerging bands such as Phish, Widespread Panic, Tedeschi Trucks, Government Mule, and Goose. Look forward to seeing you Fridays at 6 p.m. This is Matt Appel, your host for the Jam Band Hour on Friday nights at 6 p.m. I'm delighted to also be hosting a new show that's part of the Great Wide Open called the Jam Band Edition. It airs on KPFT on Tuesdays from 9:30 a.m. until noon. This 2.5-hour slot is just the right amount of time to bring you full or near full concerts of current and past jam band music. So please join me on Tuesday mornings, as well as Fridays at 6 p.m. for the best jam band music around.
Hi there, I'm Luba Dvorak, singer-songwriter here in Houston, Texas. I urge you to support KPFT because it supports local independent artists like myself. KPFT and stations like it have been major support vehicles for albums and for radio play all across the country. Being from Houston, my relationship with this station has been vital to progressing and supporting what I do. You're listening to KPFT Houston.
Tune in to Pacifica Business Talk on 90.1 KPFT FM.